Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Ralph Yorsch, and I'm chairing this meeting this evening. I might mention that for those of you who are here for the first time or have not been here too often, this society is completely self-sustaining. We rely on memberships, gifts, inheritance, anything that's legal we will take. I do invite you to become members. The fee is extremely small. The action is here every Saturday night. Please join us as a member. It is my pleasure this evening to introduce a graduate of my old school, the University of Toronto. Michael Bliss took his undergraduate work at the University of Toronto and is now a professor of history at that university and a senior fellow of Massey College. He teaches a variety of undergraduate and graduate courses and is active in the History of Medicine program while maintaining involvement in scholarship and public affairs. He's written 10 books, including A Canadian Millionaire, The Discovery of Insulin, Banting, Northern Enterprise, Plague, and Right Honorable Men, and has received numerous honors ranging from the Sir John A. Macdonald and F.X. Garneau Prizes of the Canadian Historical Association to 2 City of Toronto Book Awards, the Welsh Medal of the American Association for the History of Medicine, and the National Business Book Award. Professor Bliss writes often in Canadian periodicals, comments on national radio and television, and lectures in Canada and abroad on a wide variety of topics related to history and current issues. He's been appointed a member of the Order of Canada and elected a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada, which has also awarded him the Tyrwhitt Medal for Outstanding Work in the History of Canada. His most recent book is Sir William Osler, A Life in Medicine, published in September 1999 by the University of Toronto Press, and in October by the Oxford University Press. In Canada, it was shortlisted for the 1999 Governor General's Award for Nonfiction. Dr. Bliss's visit to UBC marks the celebration of the 50th anniversary of UBC's Faculty of Medicine, and this lecture is co-sponsored by the medical faculty. It is therefore my pleasure to introduce Professor Michael Bliss speaking on William Osler and the Canadian tradition of medical excellence. Welcome to Dr. Bliss.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to thank the Institute for inviting me to give this lecture, and particularly to thank the UBC Faculty of Medicine for co-sponsoring it on their 50th anniversary. A great deal can and should be said on occasions like this about the achievements of UBC medicine and medical research, about both the men and women who built the faculty and those who sustain it today. As a stranger from Eastern Canada, I don't have the expertise to talk to you in any detail about the excellence of the UBC faculty, but I will talk generally about excellence in healthcare on the part of Canadians. I will share my view with you that our country has been particularly blessed historically with a tradition of high achievement in medicine. That this is not accidental, but flows out of what we might properly consider Canadian values. Of course, it will not surprise you that Exhibit A, around which this lecture is organized, will be the greatest Canadian physician of all, Sir William Osler, who just happens to be the subject of my latest book. I'll begin by telling you about the life of Osler, and why he is so important in the history of medicine. And then I'll try to show you how his and others' achievements illustrates and supports the notion that when it comes to matters of health, Canada is a country that punches above its weight, a country that overachieves. If there were an Olympics of healthcare, we would be Australia. I'll begin then with an excursion into biography and by showing you a lot of slides. In 1837, the Reverend Featherston Osler, a former naval officer of Cornish descent, and his wife Ellen, arrived in Upper Canada to serve the Church of England. They were assigned to a backwoods settlement about 30 miles north of the town of Toronto in what was then a howling wilderness. In what became the village of Bond Head, the Reverend Featherston Osler proved himself not only a great clergyman, he was a kind of Anglican circuit rider, but also a grand progenitor. He and Ellen had 9 children. That's Ellen in the middle and 4 of the boys and 1 of the girls. The other is yet another prolific family. Their eldest son, Featherston, became a distinguished judge in Ontario, eventually turning down an appointment to the Supreme Court of Canada. The next in line, Britton Bath, or B.B. Osler, became Canada's outstanding trial lawyer of the 19th century, best remembered perhaps for having brought the Crown's case against Louis Riel in 1885. Their younger brother, Edmund Boyd, or E.B., went into banking, then into the investment business, and became a great 19th century financier, one of the syndicate that built the Canadian Pacific Railway, and a multimillionaire. Thus, the ubiquity of the Osler name in Canada, all Canadian Oslers are of the same family, and the proper pronunciation in Canada is Osler. And then there was little Willie, on the left in that slide, the 8th child, born 151 years ago on the 12th of July, 1849. For the Irish Protestant community, the glorious 12th, celebrating William of Orange's victory at the Battle of the Boyne. And this is why the little Osler boy was named William. It always delighted Willie and disconcerted his siblings that on his birthday the whole community seemed to hold a celebration. Most of his growing up was in the little town of Dundas, Ontario, to which the family moved when Willie was about 7. He was at first an unexceptionable child who played at least his share of schoolboy pranks and once was expelled from the Dundas Grammar School for harassing a teacher. Then the headmaster of the fledgling Trinity College School, where Osler settled down and became a prefect, brought out in him what turned out to be a passionate interest in nature, and especially nature as seen through the microscope. Osler went on from Trinity College School to the Anglicans Trinity College in Toronto with the vague intention of becoming a minister like his father, but spent more and more of his time with his microscope and then in the dissecting room at the Little Toronto School of Medicine, a doctor-run medical school in the city. At the beginning of his second year at Trinity, Osler quarreled with the provost. The details aren't exactly clear, but there may have been some problem relating to a fetus that he had brought up from the School of Medicine and that was being passed around Trinity. In any case, Osler quit Trinity and decided to study medicine. He took 2 years at the Toronto School, which wasn't very good, and then transferred to Montreal's McGill University, which was very good indeed. He graduated from McGill in 1872, did a couple of years of postgraduate study in England and Europe, and then was invited back to join the McGill faculty as a professor of the Institutes or Fundamentals of Medicine at age 25. As the baby professor at McGill, Osler began to publish his research findings, mostly pathological studies of the effects of disease on the body, at a furious rate. Here he is in the dead house instructing in pathology. He became a favorite with the McGill students when, as registrar of the faculty, he seemed to befriend all of the students, seemed to know them all personally at a time when the registrar of the university couldn't remember the names of the members of the faculty. After 10 years at McGill, Osler moved south to take up a position at the medical faculty of the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, the largest and one of the most historic medical schools in the United States. In Philadelphia, he continued his furious rate of publication. His clinical practice expanded nicely, and he developed a very wide circle of friends, not only in Canada and the United States, but in England, which he visited constantly. Then in 1889, Osler leapt at the chance to become physician-in-chief of the new Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore. It had been built with a wonderful endowment from the Baltimore merchant Johns Hopkins, who simultaneously endowed a new university. And the hospital and the university were then to found a medical school, all of which were intended to be the very best institutions of their kind in the United States, indeed in the world. There was a several years delay in opening the medical school at Johns Hopkins, and with time on his hands, Osler summed up all of his knowledge of medicine in writing what became one of the great textbooks of all time, The Principles and Practice of Medicine, first published in 1892. Osler on Medicine became a kind of Bible of English language medical education, being adopted everywhere, going through many editions, and providing substantial royalties to its author and to the woman he married immediately after completing the text, Grace Revere Osler, a great-great-granddaughter of Paul Revere. I think just a great-granddaughter of Paul Revere. The Oslers had one child, a boy, Revere, born in 1895. At Johns Hopkins in the 1890s and early 1900s, William Osler became the great North American physician. He had the reputation, the John Singer Sargent portrait of the four doctors who founded Johns Hopkins and became revered figures there. Yeah. My pointer doesn't seem to work, but on the left was William Welsh, the pathologist, standing in the back, W.S. Halstead, the surgeon. At the right, Howard Kelly, the gynecological surgeon, and then Osler. And you can see that Osler's pen is very near the exact center of the portrait. Osler had the reputation of having mastered medicine to an unparalleled extent. He was worshipped as a teacher by the students at Johns Hopkins Medical School, which was the very best in America. And he was idolized by patients who came to him from all over the United States and Canada. Dr. Osler had a charismatic personality, perhaps seen most clearly in his piercing eyes. Patients said they thought he could see right inside them, which was a neat skill to have in the age just before X-rays came in. His charisma was also expressed in an invariably cheerful disposition, sometimes cheerful to a fault, as he was an inveterate practical joker who had a bit of a past to live down because he had, in his youth, published mildly salacious fake medical articles under a pseudonym, Edgerton Y. Davis, and people have unearthed all of this and the works of Edgerton Y. Davis and M.D. are now back in print. He also possessed the rare ability to dominate a room by his very presence. One of his patients and friends wrote of him to have been a patient of Sir William Osler's was to have obtained an almost impossible idea of what a physician could be. It was not necessary for him to be sensitive to a social atmosphere because he always made his own atmosphere. In a room full of discordant elements, he entered and saw only his patient and only his patient's greatest need. And instantly the atmosphere was charged with kindly vitality. Everyone felt that the situation was under control and all were attention. No circumlocution, no meandering. The moment Sir William gave you was yours. It was hardly ever more than a moment, but there was no abrupt beginning or end to it. With the easy sweep of a great artist's line, beginning in your necessity and ending in your necessity, the precious moment was yours, becoming wholly and entirely a part of the fabric of your life. As a medical educator, Osler brought to the United States an institution that had come to McGill from Europe, the institution of the clinical clerkship, whereby medical students in their fourth year would find themselves actually working in hospitals, learning medicine not from lectures or textbooks or watching other doctors, but as real participants. This is just a slide of Osler's observation class at Johns Hopkins. That's Osler on the left, and these young medical students are seeing real patients for the first time in their education. The clinical clerkship is still a fundamental part of medical education, and Osler is especially revered in the United States for introducing the clerkship in that country. But as well as a reformer, he was respected as perhaps the greatest of all bedside teachers. And beyond that, as a physician who was also a man of broad liberal culture. Osler had a famous habit of reading good literature in the last hour of every day before turning out his light. And if you do that enough days, you'll read a lot of good literature. He became a great bibliophile, a great book collector, and essayist, specializing in giving advice and inspiration to medical students. And he was especially loved at Johns Hopkins for introducing the students to the cultivated life by inviting them to dinner at his home, where over beer and tobacco and chocolate cake, he would show them his books and talk to them about what to him was the endlessly wonderful practice of medicine. And through Osler's enthusiasm for its wonders, medicine did become an endlessly wonderful profession for the young men and women he was training, who then left Johns Hopkins and fanned out over the United States and Canada and dominated North American medicine for the next two generations. And medicine at Osler's feet was particularly fascinating because Osler's career spanned the great age of the coming of modern medicine. During his career, the great plague-like diseases were brought under control by sanitation and vaccination. Anesthesia, this is the first giving of anesthetic, which was in Boston in the 1850s when Osler was a boy. Anesthesia and control of sepsis made modern surgery possible. In the 1860s, this was the Gross Clinic, and surgeons still hacked horribly, and patients suffered terribly. By the 1890s, this was Halsted operating at Johns Hopkins, and you can see that it's recognizably modern. Osler's generation of physicians were the first, for example, to diagnose appendicitis, and the surgeons were the first to be able to do something about it. The discovery of microbes, especially bacteria, now made clear the causes of many diseases. You see photos of the plague bacteria, the cholera bacillus, the typhoid bacillus. The first of the miracle therapies started to appear. New diagnostic tools such as x-rays and blood pressure monitoring were introduced. And a great research endeavor began to develop aimed at defeating disease through scientific advance. Osler himself was not a great researcher. He discovered nothing. He was a teacher and a clinician. His textbook, it happens, was instrumental in stimulating research, for one of its readers was the key person who influenced John D. Rockefeller to support medical research. Rockefeller money began pouring into research in Osler's day. As a symbol of how fast medicine developed in Osler's time, one of his young protégés at Johns Hopkins, Harvey Cushing, who became Osler's first biographer, also became the world's first great brain surgeon, a symbol of how medicine was now ready to tackle even the most mysterious and previously untouchable of organs. At the height of his career, Osler was sensitive to accusations that physicians knew a lot about diagnosis and prognosis, very little about how to cure. Be patient, he would counsel. Therapeutic improvements are being introduced all the time. And one of those therapeutic improvements in the 1890s, Osler found especially exciting, both in itself and as a sign of more to come. This was the use of thyroid extract to treat myxedema or cretinism. Osler thought the impact of the new extract was nearly miraculous, wonderfully exciting. And he liked to illustrate it by showing these before and after pictures, before and after, before and after, of children who had been treated with the new extract. The thyroid extract contained an internal secretion from the thyroid gland, and its success immediately stimulated the search for other vital secretions, and indeed was part of the development of knowledge of a whole new area of human physiology, which became known as the endocrine system. Researchers were looking for other powerful secretions that might play a key role in illness. In a 1910 address at the University of Toronto, Osler predicted that as our knowledge of the pancreatic function and carbohydrate metabolism becomes more accurate, we shall probably be able to place the treatment of diabetes on a sure foundation. That was 1910. Well, by that time, Osler had decided to take some of the advice he was giving to his hard-driving patients, and he slowed down in his mid-50s by, in 1905, taking up an appointment as Regius Professor, King's Professor of Medicine at Oxford, a position with immense prestige but few duties. These are the Oslers relaxing in their garden at Oxford. Oxford was the absolute center of the intellectual life of the British Empire at the height of its glory. And William and Grace themselves gloried in what he called this delightful life and place. He liked to refer to himself as Reggie. His acquaintances ranged from Rudyard Kipling and Mark Twain through Henry and William James, both of whom were his patients, several prime ministers, the first generation of Rhodes Scholars, to many of whom the Oslers became surrogate parents in their beautiful home, which the students nicknamed the Open Arms, and also as a patient, Edward, Prince of Wales. In 1911, he was knighted, becoming Sir William Osler, Baronet. A little girl whom Osler had treated for diabetes and charmed with his sense of fun. Osler had a nonsense way with children, very much like Lewis Carroll. And I expect that just possibly he's been reincarnated as J.K. Rowling, author of the Harry Potter books. The little patient exclaimed on hearing the news of Osler's knighthood, "Oh dear, they should have made him king." The world of the great Victorians including the Oslers, came crashing down in the Great War of 1914 to 1918. In his 60s, the Regius professor was a busy consultant at several military hospitals, but his chief anxiety was for his son, Revere, who was now en route to becoming a soldier, taking his military training almost literally outside the Osler's house in Oxford. "Every morning," Lady Osler wrote, "we read of friends being mown down, all the youth and glory of the country, the young men we have known here, and our only boy training in the park under our eyes, except that I can't look." By the time of his 21st birthday, Revere Osler was serving on the Western Front. In August 1917, in the opening days of the Battle of Passchendaele, a stray shell destroyed Revere's unit, killing the Osler's only son, a great-great-grandson of Paul Revere, buried in France, serving as a soldier in the British Army. For all of its achievements in Osler's day, medicine still had no specific treatments for viral and bacterial infections. In 1919, Osler, who had a record of bronchial infection, suffered what appears to have been a bad bout of the influenza that was sweeping the Western world. He developed further bronchial complications, and despite having the best medical advice available, died of emphysema and bronchial pneumonia in December of that year, in his 71st year. There was some discussion immediately after Osler's death as to whether or not he had been the greatest physician in all of history. As I say in the book, that would be a tough competition. But the sense of loss that the people who had known Osler felt, the sense that medicine without Osler could not be the same again, is surely an attitude that those of us who have followed Canadian politics very carefully understand this weekend. In his day, Osler had been canonized as the saint of Johns Hopkins. There he is hovering over the hospital, and the bacteria are fleeing from him. He had, without doubt, been the most famous, the most beloved, and the most influential physician in the Western world. His friends launched strenuous efforts to perpetuate his memory through biographies, through monuments. This is the cairn at Bond Head, which is still standing. This is the cairn in Dundas. Clubs, medals, busts of Osler, Osler lectureships, and above all, the building of the Osler Library at McGill to house the magnificent book collection that he willed to McGill. Both his books and his ashes came to rest. The Osler Library became a kind of shrine for Osler worshippers, of whom there really were a number, people who thought he had been the greatest human being they had ever known, and tried to turn him into a kind of patron saint of medicine. This is the inner sanctum in the Osler Library. William's and Grace's ashes are interred behind the plaque with his books on both sides. While the extremes of Osler worship have faded over time, it still persists. In September 1997, when I was working on my biography of him in the Osler Library, I was sitting at Osler's desk, another relic kept. Maybe two relics were together that day. A freshman student slipped into the inner sanctum and placed this bouquet of flowers at the foot of the Osler plaque, along with a card asking for Osler's blessing on his studies, a pure form, a pure act of secular worship. There is no doubt that William Osler was a remarkable and wonderful and nearly unique human being. And if you want exhaustive evidence of that, I'm happy to direct you to the 504 pages of my biography and all of the reflections I go through on how difficult it is for a modern biographer to come to grips with somebody who has almost no warts. It was much easier when I wrote other biographies. But Osler was also a product of a certain society, Canadian society in the mid-19th century. And I'd like now to offer some observations on how he reflected that society and its values. This is impressionistic, and I'm going to jump around a little bit, and this is not in the biography. I think you'll see the picture I'm trying to develop. The Reverend Featherston Osler was sent out to Canada in the 1830s, not because he was a typical British clergyman, but because before studying theology, he had been an officer in the British Navy. He had sailed virtually everywhere in the world and had endured shipwreck, fights against pirates, warfare, and all sorts of hardships. It happened that Featherston Osler also turned down the opportunity to be Charles Darwin's superior as naturalist aboard the Beagle, which would have changed some things. Featherston Osler was an adventuring, tough Englishman, a classic 19th century empire builder. And his Canadian ministry featured years of the most arduous, isolated, spirit-testing labor on the Canadian frontier. At the same time, he and his wife Ellen, and Ellen was easily his match for toughness of spirit, were educated, cultured English folk, determined to raise their new world children with the values of the old world. During her fourth pregnancy, Ellen wrote to a friend that the idea of raising four children would at one time have quite startled her. Now, half a score will not surprise or trouble more than two. I learn a lesson from the wren and the dove. Cuckoo, says the dove, what shall I do? For I have got two. Twit, twit, said the wren, I have got 10, and shall bring them up like gentlemen. Ellen not only raised those children, but she then herself lived to be 100. The Oslers wanted their children to become decently educated and to enter one of the liberal professions, law or theology or medicine. And then they wanted them to do well professionally. The four high-achieving Osler boys managed to blend these conservative aspirations with their parents' vigor and drive, causing a relative to exclaim of them, "What magnificent men! They're British gentlemen with American energy." A phrase that says a very great deal, almost perfectly capturing not only the Osler values, but the dual nature of Canada itself through much of its history. A society that, unlike the United States, retained its British heritage and social values, but by virtue of being set in North America, also reflected the energy and spirit of the society of immigrants who had chosen to start over and make a new life in a new world. British gentlemen with American energy. And now consider this crucial way in which the two countries differed. The Americans, in their love affair with democracy in the 19th century, in the early 19th century, had decided that no elite or professional group should have a monopoly on professional distinction. If you wanted to be a doctor, you could call yourself a doctor. If you wanted to be a teacher of doctors, you could attend any medical school you liked. You could establish a medical school if you liked. And people would decide whether or not to avail themselves of your services as they pleased. The Americans created a wide-open medical marketplace, leading to a kind of medical chaos and extremely low standards in American medical education. In the early years of the 19th century, there was an almost complete collapse of licensing and certification, and the quality of American medical education became abysmal. Possibly its best medical school in the 1860s, Harvard, was little more than a diploma mill. And in 1870, Harvard University's president wrote, quote, "The ignorance and general incompetence of the average graduate of American medical schools is something horrible to contemplate." By contrast, Canadian medicine had never been overwhelmed by democratic values. It still reflected there's a profound truth in that, and something very deeply Canadian. It still reflected an old world concern for standards, certification, and the integrity of professional guilds and societies. The leading Canadian medical schools had taken their standards from the best European medical schools. And this meant, very simply, that when William Osler went to McGill Medical School in the 1860s, here is the very old world faculty that taught him, he was attending arguably the best medical school in North America. And when he taught there in the 1870s and 1880s, he was teaching at the best medical school in North America. Up in Canada in those days, there was a commitment to excellence in medical education and medicine that was still very rare in the United States. This is the Pathology Museum at McGill in Osler's day, which was the best in North America. And this explains why, when the American schools finally did begin to reform themselves and begin to look for the best new faculty they could find, they recruited Osler from Canada. And it explains how Osler himself, combining American energy with British medical values and British clinical training, became a leading reformer, bringing a key European aspect of medical education, the clinical clerkship, to the United States. Let me put this just another and not unfamiliar way to some of you. William Osler was a product of a society that was both European and American, that aspired to have the best of both worlds, and to be a kind of link or bridge between the two worlds, between Europe and America. Even as late as a generation or two ago, we used to understand this about Canada when we talked of the idea of a North Atlantic triangle, Britain, the United States, and Canada as a kind of hypotenuse country. The concept in foreign affairs never really amounted to as much as our diplomats would have liked it to, but it was important in medicine, where William Osler functioned as a one-man North Atlantic medical triangle, helping to carry old world excellence through Canada to the United States, where it became wedded to American wealth and determination to succeed. And this, I suggest, is symbolic of a Canadian commitment to excellence in medicine, which has made medicine something we've done very well historically. Now, I've given you only one shining example of this so far. Branch out a bit from Osler. Here's the man who succeeded him at Hopkins, Dr. Llewellyn Barker, who was also a Canadian. I meant to re-show you the four doctors, but I haven't got that slide. But the important point is that the successors of three of them at Hopkins were Canadians. The Canadian presence at Johns Hopkins during and after Osler's years was remarkable. I could read you out a long list of Canadian-born and trained Hopkins residents, interns, students, some of whom stayed, some of whom, like this man, went back to Canada, John McCrae, who was an intern under Osler at Hopkins. His brother Thomas was one of Osler's closest associates. John, as you know, became the great poet of World War I and died in France in 1918. And on his leaves, he would stay with the Osler's in Oxford. Similarly, and this is a very parallel story, a very high proportion of the Johns Hopkins nursing staff was Canadian, over 20% in the early years, including the first two superintendents of their nurses' training school. People joked about all of the hyphenated Canadians at Johns Hopkins. Osler worried that he would be accused of nepotism and became sensitive about it, so that when he was once asked at a dinner where he came from, he replied, "Well, far northern New York." Why did the U.S. Constitution require that the president be native-born? The story went, because otherwise he would be a Canadian. Many Canadian physicians and nurses still follow the north-south medical highway beaten by Osler's medical generation. They began what we worry about and sometimes disparage as a medical brain drain. But perhaps we produce a surplus of medical and other brains. It may still be true, or at least it has been until very recently, that our slightly more conservative society is geared to encouraging young people to value professional training more highly than, say, going into business. And therefore, we do tend to produce a surplus of highly trained professionals with constant export to the United States. I think the argument could be made that we also did it with theology in the 19th century, and it may now be the case that we are doing it with law today, as we are now seeing U.S. firms recruiting very vigorously in Canada, because our best and brightest young lawyers are easily competitive with theirs, and our law schools, like our medical schools, produce a very fine product. What about the Canadians who stay at home? For all of his own disdain for borders, William Osler was dedicated to doing all he could to help the Canadian medical schools retain their global leadership. He was a staunch supporter of McGill Medicine and, as a former Ontarian, of building the University of Toronto. In the early years of this century, when the University of Toronto was reformed and modernized, while McGill, among other things, was establishing a satellite college way out here on the West Coast, but back in Toronto, its faculty of medicine was expanded, a new medical school was built, and a great new teaching hospital was attached to it, and the university began a serious commitment to medical research. A movement that was inspired by the desire to perpetuate in Canada the medical values that William Osler had brought to Johns Hopkins. And the feeling that we were instilling Osler values was so strong that Osler, in fact, was offered the presidency of the University of Toronto. But by then he was at Oxford and graciously declined. It was not only Osler's spirit that medically influenced the University of Toronto and McGill. It was the spirit of the Canadian countryside itself, where after the pioneer days, there grew up generations of bright young men and eventually women who flocked to the Canadian medical schools and became their skilled alumni. Consider just one example. At the same baptismal ceremony in 1849, when the Reverend Featherston Osler baptized his son William, you may not see this very well. This is the baptismal roll. He also baptized the newborn son of one of the Irish Protestant farmers in the community, a baby named William Banting. William Banting's youngest son, Fred, Born in 1892 on the family farm in Alliston, Ontario, abandoned plans to enter the ministry and went into medicine instead. Fred Banning graduated from the University of Toronto in the class of 1917, believed, as Osler had taught, that a practicing physician should also be interested in research, and in 1920 jotted down an idea late one night that within 2 years had led exactly to what Osler had forecast a dozen years earlier, the placing of the treatment of diabetes on a sure foundation. Osler just missed living long enough to see the emergence of insulin at the University of Toronto in the early 1920s. He just missed seeing Fred Banning become Canada's first Nobel laureate in medicine. I think that Osler, had he been alive, would have been particularly excited to see these before and after pictures of what this internal secretion, insulin, could do for diabetes. And Osler would have joked about how magically medicated that baptismal water must have been back in 1849. Osler symbolizes the Canadian tradition of excellence in medical education and practice. Fred Banting and the other members of the insulin team, because it was a collaborative effort, symbolize the Canadian tradition of excellence in medical research. If I had more time, I could trace these traditions from generation to generation through to the present, to our great medical schools, to our excellent practitioners, and to our great research bodies, such as the new Canadian Institutes of Health Research. If I had knowledge, I could bring them home to you in the history of the UBC Faculty of Medicine, talking about people like Harold Kopp, talking about the great researchers we have drawn in from other parts of the world, culminating, of course, in your own Nobel laureate in chemistry, Michael Smith. If I could talk about yet another child of the manse and the little communities north of Toronto, who happened also to be a classmate of Fred Banning's at the University of Toronto. His name was Norman Bethune, and he too was an export of the Canadian spirit. Before Bethune left Canada for Spain and China, he was an early champion of socialized medicine. And it was another minister's son with very Canadian values, Lester Pearson, who finally implemented in the 1960s a Canadian approach to health care that was intended to combine the best of British models with the excellence expected in North America. The great Canadian belief in the last third of the 20th century was that we had achieved the world's finest health care system, that our stewardship of the Osler, Bethune, Banting legacy had become woven into our national life as the very essence of our national identity. Today we are engaged in intense debate about the meaning and contours and future of that stewardship. Our debate is so intense because we care so passionately about doing well in health care. And we worry about our health care system, even as our friends and our children at the UBC Medical School and other professional faculties across the land carry on the particularly Canadian legacy of excellence. Thank you. We have a question, please.
This will entertain questions. Please word them succinctly because
I'd like to hear from Dr. Bliss. Dr. Clark?
You've referred to many innovations which was involved. Could you give some comments on what may have linked a number of these major innovations?
The question is that I referred to many innovations, you mean in healthcare?
In medical research.
Yes, and could I comment on what linked these innovations? And my first comment is that's a difficult question that might take me a long time to answer. It is clear that in the late 19th century, there was a breakthrough in medical understanding that was based primarily on the application of scientific or empirically based knowledge to problems of health care. Physicians understood that they could no longer think of medicine on the basis of simple traditional preconceptions, but that to understand disease, for example, they had to do autopsies on patients. To understand disease, they had to use their microscopes to examine cadavers and find out exactly what was causing disease, that they had to begin to evaluate therapies. They began to discover through empirical study that sanitation really worked. And an advance began on all fronts, stimulated by increasing support for medical research, increasing philanthropic support, increasing state support for public health, a sense that medicine was on a new foundation and that a new age had begun. That's the best short answer I can give you.
I have an anecdote. My uncle, who graduated from McGill in chemistry, had thought of going into medicine, but he was discouraged by his doctor, who said to him, take chemistry, you'll be able to make a living.
Yes. Okay. No. That's fine. That's fine. I'm happy to have that question. I also specifically said that he, if you asked what he had discovered, he discovered nothing. There are no discoveries associated with them. There are a couple of clinical conditions that are associated with them. I'm just saying, I'm trying to bolster your point. No, that's right, he discovered nothing.
So why is he such a great guy then?
All right. Yeah, I am about to, okay? First, you remember I talked about the textbook. He wrote the textbook that became the Bible of medical education for 40 years. That's an achievement.
He wrote a textbook?
Yes. Yes. As a matter of fact, it was the first single-authored textbook of medicine that was accepted as a proper text, and it was the last, because nobody else, no other single person, mastered medicine to the extent of being able to produce a single author textbook. That textbook is still in print today with 120 authors. Now, he also was, at Johns Hopkins, an innovative medical educator whose reforms in medical education, in the introduction of the clinical clerkship, were seen to be crucial to the development of medical education in the United States in its formative years. That's another achievement. Thirdly, Osler, as a teacher and as a physician, was a mentor and role model to...
Sir, this is not the debate. And there are people who have questions. I'm sorry, sir, you are out of order.
I'll be pleased to talk with you after. I'll be pleased to talk with you after the lecture, but you now have to let others have their turn. Yes. Yes. Yes.
Clinical skills and computation textbooks also solo authorship, having influence in the practice of medicine for thousands and thousands of years.
Yes. Okay. The question is. He asked me to elaborate on the issue of whether Osler was the greatest physician in the history of medicine, and when you begin to talk about other great and influential physicians, starting with Hippocrates, going to other Chinese and Indian physicians, how can you make that comparison? And I agree with you. It is significant that people ask this question after Osler's death. It seems to me that it's an impossible comparison. And what I fell back on was to say that in the Western world in his day, there is no doubt that he was the most famous, most influential, and most loved physician. I quite agree with you that if you play that comparison game, you can go round and round it. The people, when they argued it, talked about the influence that Osler had had in the coming of modern scientific medicine and argued that nobody had done more to put medicine on a sound foundation and had had such widespread influence. Yes, the question is how to weigh the fact that Osler was very loyal to his colleagues with his professional obligations. And the particular reference is the fact that Halsted, the surgeon at Johns Hopkins, who had been thought to have broken an early cocaine addiction, which he had developed because he had pioneered in the use of cocaine as a local anesthetic. Halsted, in fact, had not broken his cocaine addiction, but as Osler knew, had simply switched it to a morphine addiction. And it was quite remarkable that the chief surgeon at Johns Hopkins, the great medical school, was a morphine addict, and Osler knew it. And in truth, was often barely functional. And I suppose the question is, why didn't Osler do something about this and let the authorities know? It's true that Osler was of a generation of doctors who believed deeply in medicine as a professional brotherhood. Whether that generation buried too many of their own mistakes is, I think, a fair question. Osler's sense was that Halsted was doing, on balance, a lot more good than harm, and that Johns Hopkins was better off with a morphine-addicted Halsted than it would have been with virtually any other surgeon you could find anywhere. There could well be an issue there. On the other hand, Osler was a very, there's a ringing statement of Osler's very early on about how research must never be done without informed consent by patients. And this is the kind of ethical position that put Osler way out in front of many generations. Yes?
Dr. Bliss, in light of current budgetary concerns, what do you think of the prospects for the continuation of excellence in Canadian medicine?
Gee, I think this guy up here asks easier questions than that. The question is, in light of budget constraints, what are the prospects for continuing Canadian excellence in medicine? And I would say that it depends on how you measure excellence. I have no doubt that our medical schools are going to continue to turn out highly trained, well-trained personnel. Are they going to turn out enough of them to spread the excellence throughout our population in terms of the access to physicians that we need? Well, that's another question. And it seems to me, and I only know what I read in the papers, and that we're facing terrible shortages of excellent personnel, and that the quality throughout our system is going to suffer dreadfully as a result of this. And this has been, a function of the vast short-sightedness of our governments.
Good question.
Yes. What's your question?
The question is, since now we know that some 80% of all institutions is carried out by private practitioners.
Your question,
sir. What's your question?
What do you think over? Do you think this, in fact, eliminates Osler's notion that there should not be
The question is a complicated one about how best to teach medicine and whether medicine is best taught by full-time professors who are doing nothing but teach, or whether it's best taught by professors who also carry on private practice on the side, as it were. And Osler felt that medical professors, in fact, should also be engaged in private practice, because unless they were actually out in the trenches, as it were, they really wouldn't understand what medicine was about. I think Osler was right. I think that Osler would be very much in favor of the fact that today much clinical teaching is done by part-time practitioners. And in fact, Osler would be very much in favor of the kinds of experiments that are going on in medical schools, as medical students are now sent out to rural communities, sent out to work with family practitioners, and that medical education is now moving just beyond the clinical clerkship in the hospital. What Osler fundamentally believed about medical education was that to make a doctor, you had to teach a student how medicine is really practiced.
Can I say, at this time, we cannot afford the luxury of elaborate preambles to questions. Word them shortly.
Sir. Yes. Is medicine still a calling today? What has happened since Osler's time is that the doctor-patient relationship, which in Osler's day was one of patient trust in the great authority of the physician, has changed. Patients, as they say, are becoming empowered. They're far better educated than ever before. When they get ill, they look up their illness on the internet and find out all about it. And they go into their physicians and they come with a lot on their minds. Physicians understand this and see that they are no longer the authority figures that Osler was, who when he found a patient with forbidden candy, just picked up the box and scattered it all over her bed. Today, the relationship is very different. Do we still respect our physicians? I think so, for the most part. I think all our polls show that we respect our physicians a lot more than we do our journalists, our politicians, our lawyers. Is medicine still a vocation? It seemed to me to be still a vocation to the bright young medical students I met at UBC yesterday. Is health important in our society? You bet it is. The question is, was I able to find current members of the Osler family who were useful to me in the preparation of the biography? And the answer is just one. Osler himself, of course, has no direct descendants. The others have a lot of direct descendants, but they know very little about Sir William. So while the other Oslers were pleasant to chat with and helpful where they could be, and also remember, here's a man who dies in 1919. Nobody's very knowledgeable, and the main source material is, in fact, in archives, and there's lots of it. I didn't need help from the family. There was one person I met who had known William Osler when she was 6 years old. They were special friends. She was full of stories about playing with Dr. Osler, about how when cake would arrive from Canada during the war, Osler would say to the little kids, "Well, you know, it's bewitched, and we've got to take the magic spells off it. And to do that, you've got to cut a square right out of the center of the cake. And when that's done, and that'll be Dr. Osler's piece, then it's okay." And she talked to me about how Dr. Osler came out when she was digging in the garden and said, "Let's dig to China." And they started digging to China, and then they got a little tired, and he said, "Well, maybe we'd better not do this. Let's wait till the war is over, and we'll fly to China instead." And she filled me with an hour of stories like that, and the magic that Osler had with children. Yes?
Osler had three Collins brothers and five sisters. Do you know anything about what three Collins?
No, that's not a, the question is, what about the accomplishments of his sisters? He had three accomplished brothers, one semi-accomplished brother, one black sheep brother, so three, four, five, six boys, two sisters. The sisters married, had children, were well brought up young, were well brought up women, but were not expected to or encouraged to do anything more. I'm sorry? Yes, the question is, which European medical schools were the ones that influenced the Canadian system? And the specific answer is that McGill medicine was based very much on Edinburgh. And think about McGill, Scotsman, Edinburgh, they were very close. And Edinburgh medicine, which was in its heyday in the Scottish Enlightenment when McGill was created, had it itself been deeply influenced by medical education in the Netherlands in the 18th century. The question is, what about the University of Vienna? Vienna comes into play in Osler's day because in some of that postgraduate training that he takes is at Vienna. And it influenced a lot of American students. But in fact, Osler was mostly influenced himself when he went to Europe by his training in the British hospitals in London, walking the wards of Guy's and Bart's and getting much of his clinical training in England. The question is, has Johns Hopkins maintained its reputation, and does it still have a strong Canadian connection? Dean Cairns will correct me, but I think Johns Hopkins is still rated very highly, is it not? And there are very large numbers of Canadians who move in and out of Johns Hopkins. And Osler is still revered at Johns Hopkins. The students who serve as interns on the Osler service in medicine at Johns Hopkins wear these ties with equanimitas on them, which was Osler's own personal motto, and he taught medical students that above all, the doctor has to retain his equanimity. What was Osler's attitude and relationship with his black sheep brother? Disappeared from their lives for 30 years. He ran off to sea and had many adventures, and then he reappeared in England when Osler was at Oxford, and they patched things up. The trouble was that Brother Frank was in fact the spitting image of Brother Willie. And Frank was trying very hard. He had a drinking problem, and he was trying very hard to dry himself out. And when he came and visited the Oslers at Oxford, he was usually sober. But he had a habit back in London of going into the bar at Brown's Hotel, which he knew was the hotel that William always stayed in. He was recognized as William. He'd drink in the bar and then sign the chits to his brother. Of all the Oslers, William was the longest lived. Frank was the longest lived. After William died, there was Frank still around London. And very many people in British medicine were extremely disconcerted when they would see the dead Dr. Osler reincarnate on the streets of London. And just in passing, the first of the very many Osler offspring who died in World War I was Frank's son. The issue is whether Osler had any influence on the medical services of the British military. That's another hard question. He was, by then, very near retirement. He had some effect in promoting things like vaccination for typhoid, was called on when there was an outbreak of meningitis among the 1st Canadian Division on Salisbury Plain. I wouldn't think that he had a crucial influence in British medicine, but he did his share in what became a very vast British medical effort.
Professor Bliss, I'm sure that there's not one of us that won't walk out of here standing taller than when we came in.
Well, maybe up there, but... Thank you.
Well, I would like to call on Dean Cairns of the School of Medicine to express our thanks to Professor...
This has really been a remarkable evening. William Osler remains a towering figure in the world of medicine, and his writings and his personal example of intelligence, hard work, and humanity continue to inspire medical students and practicing physicians worldwide. We know as well that his influence on the practice of medicine and the ideals he espoused extend far beyond the narrow world of medicine. I think that's evidenced here this evening by this engaged audience and by the wide readership of Michael Bliss's book about William Osler. This autumn, when Maclean's magazine named the 25 Canadians who have inspired the world, Osler was at the forefront. And who better to write his biography and to bring Osler to modern audiences? Who better than Michael Bliss? Dr. Bliss, as you've heard this evening, is a distinguished academic. He's a professor of history at the University of Toronto. But in addition, he has that skill that is so often lacking in academics, the capacity to communicate verbally, as you've heard this evening, but also in writing. And he brings the interest in William Osler far beyond the narrow community of medicine and of health. His thorough scholarship, combined with his human interest and his engaging style, have made history, and particularly Canadian medical history, accessible and made it live with countless numbers of people. His talents have been very much in evidence this evening. His mastery of his topic, his clarity, his humor, his equanimity under fire. This is not just a sleepy Saturday night audience. The questions, I think, have been challenging, and the responses have been what we have come to expect from Michael Bliss. He gives us many insights into the life of William Osler and the traditions of excellence in Canadian medicine. We've been privileged to have Michael as our guest here at UBC and in the Faculty of Medicine here in Vancouver, and to share this evening with him. I have two gifts. The first is from the BC Medical Association. The BC Medical Association is celebrating its 100th anniversary this year, and they have commissioned a wonderful video, which actually will be shown on Global TV shortly, looking at medical milestones in the past 100 years in British Columbia. And Michael, this comes to you on behalf of the BC Medical
Good.
Association.
Thank you.
And another auspicious anniversary this year is the 50th anniversary of the Golden Jubilee of the Faculty of Medicine here at British Columbia, University of British Columbia. And we see Michael Bliss as a very important part of this celebration. And we would like to thank you for your presence. I'm in this sweatshirt,
Good.
Which contains the logo of the Golden Jubilee. This is commissioned by a Haida artist. This is a frog emblem, which is emblematic of health, healing, support. We feel a very warm symbol of medicine in British Columbia and the tradition of UBC's Faculty of Medicine.
And thank physiology.
You. Yes. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
With Thanksgiving next weekend, there will be no lecture.
Hmm? Oh, yes.
Do come back on the 14th of October. Dr. Alice Mansell, Vice President Academic, New Technical University of British Columbia.